Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And boy, are there many. Tuesday, April 4th, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Melody. How are you?
I'm doing real well. I'm on the phone right now doing the I'm kind of hooked up to the producers two ways, by computer and phone, but
I'll switch over here in just
a little bit.
Glad to have you.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. How are you?
Well, I am good. Enjoying what a gorgeous spring day. A lot of craziness out there in the world. We're going to talk about a bunch of it today. And it sounds like it's a good time to just get started with the market report.
Yep, absolutely. And I do believe this is a day that's going to be going, it's where we're making history today. How about that?
Hey.
You know? With President Trump and what's going on in New York, and history is being written as we speak. So I guess every day is maybe a history day. Who knows? But anyway, I guess every day is to some degree. But gold will take a little bit of a reporting, too. We had, for history, up $36.70, 2022. I think the COMEX was actually a little bit higher. Let me see if I can bring that up real quick without losing my spot here. And here we go. Let's see what COMEX closed at. Gold. COMEX gold is actually 2039. So, yes, it was higher. So, a good day for gold. And let's take a peek at silver. Silver's up over a buck, 4.25%, 2507. I think COMEX was higher on silver, too. Platinum was, this is the New York spot price aftermarket that I'm reading. Platinum was up 30, 1029. Palladium was down 12 at 1544. The USDX today was down. Was down 0.49 at 101.56. Crude oil was up 6 cents at 80.48. Paper markets today. The Dow was down 200 points, 33,004. S&P was down 23 points, 4,100. NASDAQ was down 63 points to 12,126. Europe, let's see what Europe's done. The DAX was positive. Everything else was negative. Asia was positive, except for the Hang Seng. 10-year yield, I think that took a beating today, 3.34%, 3.34. Can't imagine natural gas done any better. That's down 2.096, so I did do too much on that level. So a great day in gold. Really not sure. If I could pinpoint one particular thing, except the world is a mess, and it's coming from every direction. And I think people are now beginning to, when you have these too big to fail, Jamie Dimon come out and said, "Hey, folks, we haven't seen anything yet." And someone else comes out and says, "Hey, you know, the stocks are going to get hammered." Even the threat of higher rates hasn't pressured gold at all. So I think with a lot of these negative reports, and we're going to be talking about some of them that are coming out about the economy, Dave, people are going to the one item that they know will be there as they begin to question their paper investments. And one of those reports, again, we talked a little bit about this yesterday, was the domestic oil with, you know, hitting a low of 66.74 just on March 17th. It's over 80. And so people are beginning to adjust. I mean, this is certainly inflationary. And, of course, with the OPEC announcing to axe oil production. So now we have oil as a major, you know, we get that it's a major input for the global prices for everything. It's a key cost to just about every product produced, commodities. So it's a big impact. The cartel of global oil producers, we see Saudi Arabia is arguably the key player. They're going to cut by 1.16 million barrels per day by May. We saw oil prices jump. And then I think also we see oil prices jump based on this news because we've seen the agreements with India and these other nations to buy oil and other currencies, Dave.
Yeah, I think that's a big component here. I mean, Carolyn Bain at Capital Economics said, and I agree with this, it's not hard not to think that there's some geopolitical posturing embedded in these voluntary cuts. Demonstrating OPEC support for Russia and, of course, flying in the face of the U.S.'s efforts to lower oil prices. On the other side, despite these political strains, analysts say the announcement appears rooted less in politics than in signs that the post-pandemic rebound of economic activity is fading. He thinks that's a tad naive. In any event, recently released data on factory activity, we'll get into that a little bit more shortly, shows a trend of decelerating industrial activity among the giants, China, U.S., Japan. So Rystad Energy, which is a major energy research firm, says from a demand-side perspective, these cuts may be signaling that OPEC Plus believes there are enough recessionary indicators in the market. But as you suggested, Melody, yeah, either that or the Saudis are in the midst of manipulating markets as part of their desire to move away from the U.S. dollar.
We know, and the thing of it is also, it's like, okay, you know, now we're all supposed to be going green and we're cutting back oil productions over here and whatnot and so forth. So, yeah, it's a whole change in policy that they're protecting their pricing on oil and so forth. It's probably a combination of everything, but I think the biggest component really is the move away from the U.S. dollar. And I think that's why we're seeing the higher gold prices as a big part of that. And, you know, and this is kind of a scratch-your-head number. Job openings slipped to 7% to 9.9 million. How's that happen? With all these layoffs from the tech industry and everywhere else that we're seeing, but yet the job openings slipped to 9.9. I guess that would make sense, though, wouldn't it, Dave? Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I think
there's
so.
Less job openings. There should be more job openings. So, yeah, it doesn't make sense, right?
Right. So you're right.
Yeah.
Or I agree with you. Let's put it that way.
Do you know what you're agreeing to?
I do.
Okay.
If I let's put it this way. If I understand you correctly, yes.
So, yeah, so it really doesn't make sense. Unless a lot of these jobs that were posted are now being taken up by the illegal aliens that are coming into this nation. So, not sure. Vacancies fell from 10.6 million in January. Well, it wouldn't be in the healthcare and in professional services, managerial, technical jobs. Openings rose for construction workers. Despite the drop, the number of layoffs ticked lower in February. Let's see, the surge in consumer prices, we've seen it ease a little bit since mid-2022, but of course we're still way over the target that they want. Hiring was expected to slow this year after 2021 and 2022, the two best years for job creation. And I'm not buying that, Dave. It isn't the best 2 years for job creation. It's people coming back from a job after the, you know, after the economy was shut down. So these jobs were not created. It was just people going back to work. Two different things. So we're at the same spot as where we were. And then I would even have to debate that. But go ahead, Dave.
Well, after an average of about 400,000 jobs added in January and February, economists think there's another 240,000 to come in March. That's according to FactSet. Till 2021, monthly job openings never surpassed 10 million in the Labor Department's job opening and labor turnover survey, but they had broken that threshold for 20 straight months until February. Economist Chris Rupke says the strongest labor market since the 60s is starting to show a few cracks. He believes the drop in openings might signal that payroll employment is set to slow in the months ahead, which should help keep inflation pressures in check. Again, that is his perspective. Strong labor market, as we know, can put upward pressure on wages and overall prices. Still, the Fed is trying to achieve a soft landing that is slowing the economy enough to reach its inflation goals without tipping our economy into recession. I think it's a matter of, I think it's foregone conclusion. And it's not a matter of if, but when. And I mean, parts of the economy are already and have been in recession. The classic definition, two straight quarters of negative growth. I guess it's anyone's guess whether that's going to happen in the second or third quarter or by the end of the year. But many economists believe that that's on the horizon, Melody.
Well, here's an interesting note. Finland became the 31st member of NATO today. You know, timing is everything. It's just, you know, I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. And, you know, Finland's foreign minister, Pekka Haavisto, formally wrapped up the process by handing Helsinki's accession papers to the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, the formal keeper of NATO's founding treaty. With receipt of this instrument of accession, we now declare that Finland is a 31st member of the North Atlantic Treaty. And I was trying to find out what who's going to pay for fill-in. How much did they pay already, or when did their dues start, and so forth. And I would think that if a new nation has started, then maybe perhaps ours could be lowered a little bit as they're getting additional funds. I don't know.
Don't count on that.
Yeah, I know.
Not this year.
It should. It should. NATO's chief, Jens Stoltenberg, said that the Vladimir Putin had wanted to slam NATO's door shut, blah, blah, blah. So this does guarantee Finnish leaders, though, decided they need it as they are concerned what Putin might do. And it's a great day for Finland, the Finnish president said, and that it was an important day for NATO.
Yeah, Moscow, on the other hand, reportedly erupted in fury at the official announcement, which doubles Russia's land border with NATO member states to 1,550 miles, branding Finland's acceptance as an assault on Russia's security and national interest. Now, invaded by its giant neighbor, the Soviet Union, in 1939, Finland stayed out of NATO throughout the entire Cold War and afterwards. Now its membership brings a potent military into the alliance with a wartime strength of close to 300,000 and one of Europe's largest artillery arsenals. Be interesting to see what portion of that gets pressured to be sent to Ukraine. So that very interesting development. It happened in under a year, makes it the fastest membership process in NATO's recent history. Finland's arrival is bittersweet for some, however, who had hoped that Sweden would come on board at the same time, but Hungary and Turkey remain holdouts after belatedly agreeing to waive Helsinki. Of course, Ukraine is also pushing for NATO membership, but Western diplomats say that remains a distant prospect, Melody.
Well, you know, here's an interesting, I think because it was shut down for so long, new vehicle sales rose 7.5% in the first quarter as we see supplies improve. Some of those sky-high prices, they eased a little bit. The computer chips seem to, the shortage has waned a little bit. But the average auto loan rate hit 7% during the quarter, leaving open the question of whether automakers are going to make some sort of reduced rate offers just to keep buyers interested through the rest of the year. Automakers sold 3.6 million vehicles during the first 3 months of this year, compared to 3.3 million just last year, a year earlier. So a lot of these results are mixed. Some thrived with better chip supplies while others continue to struggle. General Motors sales jumped 80% over a week first quarter last year as the Buick brand deliveries doubled. The company said it picked up 1.5 points of market share. GM's dealer inventory rose 50% in the quarter to more than 412,000 as production increased. Are they talking about Buick?
Yes.
You know, Buick is, well, no, I don't think all Buicks are made in China, but some of those Buicks are made in China, I believe. So, Nissan, I don't know if these are U.S. sales or the world sales, too, but I can't remember. One of Buick's most popular brands, that small SUV, I think is made in China, if I remember correctly.
It didn't say, but based on the numbers from some of these other companies that are based abroad, I suspect the GM numbers are global.
Are global, but I'll have to think of which of that Buick is made in China. But anyway, Nissan sales leaped 17%, and Honda posted a 12% increase. Hyundai was up 15.5%. Kia was up 22% combined to outsell Stellantis, which saw a 9% sales decline. What does Stellantis sell?
The Jeeps, I believe.
Okay. All right, I hear the music. That only means one thing. We're heading into a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE talkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. Brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Great day for gold. New York spot price up $36 at 2021. Silver's up a buck, over a buck at 2508. Platinum's up $30. At 1,029, and so a good day in the precious metals. Premiums held today, but I would expect them to be higher tomorrow. And so there's no point in waiting to see if prices are going to come down. Could we actually see a pullback in gold? Of course we can. Could we actually see a little bit of a pullback in silver? Of course we can. But then again, maybe we will, maybe we won't. That's why you can't time the markets. And you know, and it's just a great time to be buying. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Everything is pretty much live. The only thing that we have delays by 2 and 3 weeks are the Canadian maple leaves. Gold maple leaves are out 3 weeks, and the silver mapes are out, they're delayed by 2 weeks. So everything else, the fractional gold pieces for the American Gold Eagles, they're delayed. The 1 ounce is not. So the 1 ounce is live. The biggest delay in shipping is basically logistics, is because our larger orders all come from the depository. And, you know, it takes time to get, you can only ship so many packages a day. So 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. 4188. Don't delay, ladies and gentlemen. So we're heading into the second break, talking about a little bit about how the Fed has botched the handling of the economy. So maybe we're going to count the ways by we're going to use Mohammed El-Erian's way. And in an op-ed for the Project Syndicate yesterday, he is a chief economic advisor. He points to the Fed's failings in the way they have handled the higher inflation problem over the past year. Now, the problems chiefly lie in the Fed's delayed response to inflation. And I think we all remember the word transitory. Do we? And they just dismissed. Basically, that's what they did. They dismissed any inflation at that point in time. And so that forced them to aggressively hike rates in 2022. But these rate hikes have, you know, again, you can't go from free money to start raising rates, interest rates, and not have some sort of a impact on the economy as we see this liquidity rapidly withdrawn. And that's what has ballooned these asset prices. We've seen stocks tumble from their highs of 2021 last year, and that ain't nothing yet. Just wait. We even saw gold down. Gold was just down 0.3%, and silver was actually up 2.9%. The Fed's rate hikes have literally hammered the banking system. We saw what happened to the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank last month. Again, illustrating the risks to the U.S. banks as they continue to sit on these large amounts of long-term bonds that have just tanked in value. And it hasn't been helped either by the Fed's inconsistent communications to markets. According to the Center for Economic Policy Research, market volatility is three times greater whenever the Fed Jerome Powell speaks. So again, you know, he's speaking. It's not what they do. It's what they say. It's what they speak. From Alan Greenspan, we don't change that much. It's what we say changes the markets. And so, again, this is reflecting. This is what El-Erian is saying, that how it reflects poorly on the Fed and that they're wrong. And they're all wrong. Dave, they're all going to be wrong as long as they're trying to promote the glass everything is rosy theory. So,
yeah, the glass always be half full. Well, the bruised reputation of the Fed and central banks around the world spells trouble for the economy on its own, according to El-Erian. And, you know, it's the public's lack of trust in the Fed to control inflation and achieve financial stability could cause both to spiral. He noted the Fed's problems should worry everyone. Adding, a loss of credibility directly affects its ability to maintain financial stability and guide markets in a manner consistent with the dual mandate of maintaining this price stability while supporting maximum or full employment. Cracks have begun to show on the surface, a warning that the Fed has already undermined its own credibility. According to El-Erian, there has never been a time when markets have so strongly dismissed the Fed's forward guidance on the economy. In fact, central bankers and markets are pricing in different inflation expectations that have spread as far as a full percentage point from the Fed's, the Fed governors and FOMC policymakers. But El-Erian believes the Fed can still repair its damage or its, you know, its image, thinking that a recession isn't completely inevitable. Well, he lost me there. But what he's doing is urging the Fed to right the ship by incorporating more diversity in their viewpoints, such as adding two external voting members and taking accountability for its mistake over the past year. I particularly like the external voting members. But, you know, like with regular members, it all depends on who they are. In any event, he's chiefly concerned that failure to correct their course is going to lead to stagflation, a viewpoint shared by Dr. Doom, Noriel Rubini, who's predicted that kind of debt crisis ahead, which he says will combine the worst aspects of 70s stagflation and the 2008 Great Recession.
Well, you know, that's really interesting. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the lending activity tightening. But, you know, it's interesting. I will know more tomorrow. And but it'll be interesting to see what I've been trying to kind of read through what these indictments against Trump are and what they say and how credible they are. And it's going to be interesting, but so we'll keep everyone posted tomorrow as far as our analysis of what is going on. And are you available tomorrow, Dave?
I am not, unfortunately.
Okay. Lending activity tightening in normal times. Surveys on banking conditions are released with little fanfare. Now there's an increased appetite on just how these banks, an appetite for data on how banks across the rest of the country are faring. There's yet another clue now after the release of a survey of some banks and credit unions based in the Dallas's Fed's district covering Texas and parts of Louisiana and New Mexico. The latest survey conducted in the weeks after the collapse of Silicon Valley and Signature Banks showed lending conditions and terms for loans tightened sharply and marked rises in loan pricing. This is from the, according to the Dallas Fed, Dave.
Yeah, an index for credit standards slumped to negative 36 from negative 36. That's 20% in February, suggesting that more respondents reporting that they were continuing to tighten up on their lending. Overall loan volume plummeted. This is an index, plummeted to minus 18 from plus 5 in the prior survey. That's a significant drop. Most respondents reported no change in business activity over the past 6 weeks, but an overwhelming share say they expect activity to slump over the next 6 months. Now, in comments collected by the Dallas Fed, one business official said that the recent banking strain has resulted in a crisis of confidence. Another said the additional impact of interest rate hikes has put the economy in a hard landing recession. And a third added, our commercial customers have sticker shock when their 3 or 5 year rate adjustments are coming due. Pricing for good commercial loans is getting very competitive. Plus this next story combined with tightening credit. I guess on the one hand, is something the Fed will like. Again, it's just a matter of the extent to which all of this is going to come together, i.e. soft landing or hard landing, or how hard of a landing and how long.
Well, you know, I saw these numbers yesterday and I didn't have a chance to report on them, but the global manufacturing shows, really signs of contracting activity in American, Chinese and Japanese factories. They're contracting. And they did so in March. This is according to a recent manufacturing survey. The latest data points on the highly cyclical industrial portion of the economy provide balance to those of us who are expecting a downturn. China, Japan, and the U.S. Generate more than 50% of the value of industrial activity. And we're about 11% of that, maybe. Or less. Oh, we have as much as 17%. China, 30% of the world's manufacturing output. The U.S. and Japan have 17% and 7%. Global factory activity weakened in March. Of course, as we've seen, the pinch from the rising living costs cutbacks. U.S. manufacturing activity slumped to the lowest level in nearly 3 years as new orders continue to contract. This is a monthly survey by the Institute for Survey Management showed. PMI fell to 46.3 last month. And this was actually the lowest reading since May of 2020 from 47.7 in February, Dave.
Yeah, and this is the fifth straight month that the PMI remains below the 50 threshold, which indicates contraction in the manufacturing sector. But the so-called hard data have suggested that manufacturing, which accounts for over 11% of the economy, continues to grow moderately. Rising borrowing costs as the Fed fights inflation have cooled demand for goods, which are typically bought on credit. Demand could also come under further pressure following the recent failure of Silicon Valley and Signature Banks and the takeover of Credit Suisse, which stressed the financial sector. The ISM survey did also show work backlogs continuing to shrink last month, reflecting a drop in demand as well as improved supply chains. In the Eurozone, factories also saw a further decline last month, although there too the cost of manufacturing fell for the first time since mid-2020.
Labor Department's latest job openings and labor turnover survey. Every month we turn to the JOLTS, Dave. We do, right?
We do.
I know. So it gives us into an idea of what's really happening among businesses and their workers. In February, it was kind of a strange one. There were signs that the labor market is finally cooling, alongside some evidence that conditions remain as tight, perhaps even overheated as ever. And as we mentioned in today's first segment, the number of job openings and employers reportedly dropped by 632,000 in February. Did we report that?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if we skipped over that or not. I was being on the telephone. It creates just a strange thing.
A lapse in connectivity.
I know.
No. This is just an attempt to.
Oh, I'm thinking of the job. I was actually thinking of the jobs report.
Oh, okay.
That comes out Friday.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Okay, I knew I wasn't crazy. But anyway, in the first segment today, the number of job openings employers reported dropped by 632,000 in February, reaching the lowest level since May of 2021. Now, this is a consistent with a story in which employers react to a slowing economy by, well, of course, they're going to pull back on hiring. But the very same report showed that hiring remained steady and that the number of people laid off or discharged from their jobs fell. Meanwhile, voluntary quits actually rose. None of those are what you would expect to see in a labor market slump. Normally, downturns cause companies to slow hire dramatically. They fire workers and prompt those remaining to hold on to their jobs for dear life. You see a lot of retirements. And while the ratio of job openings to unemployed Americans fell in February, it remained in the same historically high range it's been since late 2021, Dave.
Yeah, still just under two job openings per jobless adult. Now, this isn't like last year where employers were just, I mean, breakneck hire at all cost. But at the same time, despite what we see in the tech and media industry, they're not actually cutting jobs overall. Meanwhile, workers feel as empowered as ever, still quitting at historically high rates, apparently confident they can find new work. New data also consistent with the term labor hoarding, where employers who are burned by the difficulty hiring over the past couple of years are avoiding layoffs and continuing to hire even as demand softens.
There it is, the music. We're heading into the break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Such a fine sight to see. It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. Come on, babe, don't say babe. I gotta know if your sweet love is gonna save me. We may lose and we may win, but we will never be here again. So open up.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE talkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
One more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, Melody taking care of client business, this final segment. You know where to reach her, 1-800-375-4188. Now, Courtney Brown and Neil Irwin opened a recent column with these startling headline-like declarations. Sunday night bank bailouts on both sides of the Atlantic, joint announcements by global central banks, fear and uncertainty sweeping the markets. Well, they say the last 10 days have felt similar in that respect to the Great Recession of 15 years ago. But there are crucial differences that lower the risk, they say, that recent events will have the same seismic impact on the world economy as it did back then. We will see. Undoubtedly, the still unfolding run on bank deposits has raised the odds of a recession even more, especially with the Fed's hell-bent focus on bringing down inflation at virtually whatever cost. But when you drill down on what's actually happening, you might think twice about this becoming an all-out mega crisis. Brown and Irwin explain the root cause of the two crises. In 2008, they note, all kinds of highly leveraged institutions owned complex derivative securities, particularly backed by home mortgages, that turned out to be far less valuable than advertised. the 2008 crisis, they argue, was effectively a series of institutions either failing or being bailed out by U.S. taxpayers as those losses became apparent. This time around, the root problem isn't bad loans, at least per se. Granted, there are plenty of bad loans out there that should have never been made. Rather, the Fed's rapid credit tightening has created significant paper losses for banks that made loans or bought long-term bonds when rates were a lot lower. And these paper losses have been pressuring many depositors to withdraw their cash, forcing those banks to sell the bonds, turning paper losses into real ones. My blog on Friday will give you a little more of a technical explanation about how that scenario works. Now, Brown and Irwin point to three major differences between now and then. First, they say what made the 2008 crisis so tough was that many losses occurred in a system that was lightly regulated or unregulated altogether. For example, remember Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and AIG, the giant insurance company? Well, regulators at the time had limited visibility into the massive market for asset-backed securities. Fast forward to 2023, the problems this time around are happening in traditional banks. For one thing, these institutions have an entire infrastructure of deposit insurance, access to nearly unlimited emergency Fed funding, and supposed oversight, to reassure the public about their solvency. Second, since the post-2008 reforms in the Dodd-Frank Act really did change some things. Certainly not as much as advertised, but better than it had been. Most importantly, bank capital ratios are higher by law now than they were in 2008, dramatically so at the largest globally systemically important banks, giving them a greater financial cushion for downturns like now. And regulators have more authority to deal with even a too-big-to-fail bank, which is intended to prevent, you know, a scenario like what followed Lehman's bankruptcy back then. And third, and perhaps most importantly, the problems now should have less risk of feeding on themselves in the kind of vicious cycle that made the Great Recession so damaging. If, say, the economy were to start to falter because of a credit crunch brought on by QT, continued banking turmoil, or other factors, the Fed could put on the brakes and start cutting rates. Well, that in turn could ease the pressure on bank balance sheets that created the credit squeeze in the first place. Brown and Irwin contrast that to 2008, when lots of bad mortgages soured credit markets and slowed the economy. Then, weakening growth caused more mortgage defaults. It was a self-accelerating cycle, not a self-correcting one. But there are other differences between then and now that Brown and Irwin say could cut the other way. One needs to look no further, they say, than the political environment in Washington today compared to then. Should congressional action be needed to rescue the financial system, it would likely be next to impossible for the Biden administration to get enough votes, perhaps in either house. But getting really out of control in the fall of 2008, the Bush administration proposed the $800 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, known as TARP. The Democratic House leadership was on board, even though the bailout program was widely unpopular with the voting public. Even with Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a 38-seat House majority, there were enough no votes that TARP actually failed on its first vote, sending markets into a tailspin. Now, it's hard to imagine a Republican speaker striking a deal with Biden for any rescue plan today. And if he did, the peril of his speakership, it would be even less clear where any other R votes would come from. Plus, we got the debt ceiling impasse that looks likely to play out this summer. That would add to complexity and risk to an already highly volatile financial backdrop in ways we just don't know. And while Dodd-Frank strengthened regulation to some extent, It also restricted the Fed's ability to use its emergency lending authority for bailouts to prevent anything like, say, the AIG bailout from happening again. So there are important reasons to think that the recent banking troubles should be more manageable and less disastrous than the crisis 15 years ago. But this is what Brown and Irwin conclude. The nature of a financial crisis is that events move fast and in nonlinear, unpredictable ways. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, hold on to your hat. The wild ride continues. Hey, our latest American Survival newsletter hit the streets. It features Doug Nolan's Credit Bubble Bulletin blog, his weekly blog, and Apothecary Herbs' Wendy Wilson's Food for Thought on Eye Health. There's also Melody's weekly financial market recap, plus I have an article on the ongoing banking crisis. Yes, crisis. David Hollerith reports that depositors pulled another $126 billion out of the U.S. banks in the week ending March 22nd, this time primarily from the nation's largest institutions. In fact, the largest 25 banks in the U.S. by asset size lost $90 billion, according to the Fed. Smaller banks, which suffered a huge run the previous week as regional lenders Silicon Valley and Signature Banks were going bust, were able to stabilize their assets, at least temporarily, gaining back $6 billion. Total industry deposits fell to $17.3 trillion, down 4.4% from the same week a year ago, the lowest level since July 2021. Hollerith says the new numbers reinforce some trends that were already in place. For example, deposits had been falling at all banks before the Silicon Valley failure. In the first 2 months of this year, deposits at all banks were also down 5% annually in last year's fourth quarter. Many observers attribute this systemic shift to pressure being applied by the Fed's aggressive campaign, dare I say obsessive, to bring down inflation closer to its 2% target. During the early part of the pandemic, when interest rates were virtually zero, banks were drenched in deposits. When the Fed started raising those rates last March to cool the economy, customers who had deposits began seeking out places with higher yields. Now, the first year-over-year deposit decline for all banks came in the second quarter last year. As we've pointed out, a chunk of this money has been flowing to money market funds, which are offering investors a rate of return in the range of 3, 4, and even 5%. Since January 1st, investors have poured over $500 billion into those funds. That's a lot of money. That's the highest quarterly inflow since a peak earlier in the pandemic, and another $60 billion was added to these funds in just the past week. Government banking officials have been working to prevent massive deposit outflows in the aftermath of last month's bank failures. Federal regulators pledged to cover all depositors at both banks they seized, hoping that would calm any panic, and they also promised to help other regional banks if needed. 11 megabanks also decided to provide another troubled regional lender, First Republic, with $30 billion in uninsured deposits to stabilize its dire situation. Now, the challenge that outflowing deposits create for all banks is that if they raise rates on their deposits to keep or attract customers, their profits fall, making shareholders wary, making boards of directors start looking at one another, and particularly looking at their CEOs who wonder, oh gosh, am I going to get a $20 million bonus this quarter? But if they lose too many customers, as SVB did, they lose critical assets and may have to sell assets like long-term treasuries at a loss to cover those withdrawals. SVB customers withdrew $42 billion in one day, leaving the bank with a negative cash balance of $958 million, forcing regulators to seize the bank, which at the time was the 16th largest in the U.S. Some are asking, are reverse repos to blame? In 2013, the Fed's big concern was that with the world inundated with dollars that they had created, they wouldn't be able to raise interest rates even when they felt they had to. Their solution was a tool that 10 years later has swelled to a massive $2.6 trillion as of last Wednesday. It's making bank officials angry because they believe it's a major factor in their recent loss of deposits. The Fed's overnight reverse repurchase agreement facility, ONRRP, lets money market mutual funds accept vast sums of investors' money and pay their customers higher interest rates than banks typically do. That's great for conservative savers who want higher yields on their cash, but as Neil Irwin writes, is contributing to the destabilization of the banking system as depositors pull their funds. 10 years ago, the Fed worried that when it decided to raise rates, it wouldn't be able to actually change the price of money across the economy unless money market funds and other entities would access cash at that rate from the Fed. The ONRRP was supposed to be a solution to that problem. Irwin notes that it allowed money funds to park money at the Fed if there aren't enough treasuries and other super safe investments available to buy at something close to the Fed's target interest rate. Irwin points out that usage of the reverse repo was zero 2 years ago, but has soared as the Fed has tightened. In fact, these repurchase agreements are now a major holding of popular money market funds. For example, Fidelity Government Money Market Funds, $246 billion in assets at the end of February. 55%, $136 billion, were repo agreements with the New York Fed. Banks view this as unwelcome competition. Their access to liquidity and safety from the Fed are threatened by the lightly regulated money market funds. The Bank Policy Institute, the research arm of the bank lobbyist industrial complex, this week called the ONRRP a black hole for bank deposits. The BPI's Greg Baer and Bill Nelson argue that the reverse repo is essentially sucking money out of the banking system that would be put to much more productive use for the economy if it stayed in the banks. But Irwin argues this is largely the bank's fault because they've enjoyed the benefits and resulting profits of paying depositor rates that are far below the Fed's policy rate. And banks themselves have the ability to park money at the Fed and receive interest on it in the form of reserves and excess of their own regulatory requirements. Plus, banks also have access to the ONRRP. Former Fed Vice Chair Richard Clarida noted last week, if the reverse repo facility were to go to zero as it did in 2017, that would be roughly $2 trillion that would flow into the banking system. I do think, he continued, at some point the Fed does have to think about what the role of the reverse repo facility is. He added that it worked well for its purpose of keeping a floor under interest rates during his time at the Fed, but it's not doing that now. It's a question mark, and I'll leave it at that. You know what, ladies and gentlemen? So will I, for now anyway. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll return on Thursday. Hopefully I'll be able to join Melody as well tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks always to our producer, Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.
In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball.
Broadcasting to the U.S. and around the world by way of Clear Digital Audio, 22,500 miles above.